64.
Hello and welcome. This is Anger Management. My name is Georg Dietz.
I'm Karin Pettersson.
And this is the podcast for ideas, new ideas about democratic thinking.
And this podcast we started in the US, but now we have transitioned back to Europe. And this week we met with Anne Applebaum in Poland.
In her lovely, lovely country house.
Yes, it was a magical drive and a magical day.
4 hours from Warsaw, she sits there and thinks a lot about the questions that we're interested in this podcast. The rise of authoritarianism, the weakness of democracy, and the relationship to technology.
Yes, and Anne Applebaum, of course, is an American journalist. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner. She has written these great books about Gulag and the Iron Curtain.
And just now, Big Famine, about the hunger in Ukraine in the 30s, Stalin's terror.
So she's one of the big public intellectuals of our time. And we had a conversation about these topics and started with asking questions about the rise of authoritarianism in the West and in the East, and if that's different or if it's similar. And then we talked about the role of digital and social media.
Yeah, and she's an expert on that. She just started a research group at LSE about that, the connection between, digital propaganda.
And disinformation.
Yeah, as an expert in Russia, so she's knowledgeable on that front. And I think the overarching theme was democracy and the beauty and the fragility of it, so how it works as a system of beliefs, and how it only works if you carry the norms within yourself.
And as usual, the pendulum was swinging between, hope and despair in this conversation.
Yes.
So enjoy.
Enjoy.
So let me start like this. I read a column by you where you said that the threat to the West or to Europe is not from the outside. It's not from radical Islam. It's from the inside. It comes from inside. And you're an expert on populism and authoritarianism. And I would just like you to maybe start with this conversation with expanding on what you meant in that column, that the threat comes from the inside.
So the threat to European democracy and more broadly to the idea of the liberal West, in other words, a community of nations which share a set of values, democratic values, belief in regulated free trade, you know, the idea of the West as a community, the real threat to that has always been, was always going to be ideological. And the real threat is that people within the West cease to believe in those values or cease to believe in those ideas, cease to support them, and the institutions that keep the West together then fall apart. I think, you know, if I'm talking about a threat to the West, that's what I meant. I mean, of course, there are ways in which both radical Islam and a revanchist Russia can also help undermine that community of the sort of community of democracies, the economic community, the free trade communities that the West has created, the rule-based free trading order that the West has created. Radical Islam can undermine it by frightening people so much that they question whether democracy really works for them. They bring in a much harsher security state. They recreate borders. They prevent the free movement of people. They prevent even the free movement of goods and so on. So that you can see how radical Islam could become that kind of threat. The Russian threat is also an internal threat because Russia funds anti-Western and anti-democratic groups and people and parties inside Europe and inside the United States, actually, as we learned during the last election. And this is not a trivial thing. This is not a small thing or a fringe thing. It's an important, it's an important influence on politics in a lot of countries. More visible in smaller countries where a little bit of money goes a long way. Yeah. Less visible in larger countries. But even so, I wouldn't, for example, underestimate the Russian attempts to influence Germany and German politics. you know, as well as obviously Polish politics, Slovak politics, Italian politics.
Can I jump in? And
sure. Sort of,
because I think it's really interesting in terms of if you think of the story of the West as a story, so of that of democracy as a story that people have to sort of understand and believe. That's, I think, interestingly true if you think about Trump's, of the way that you have to believe in the sort of separation of powers to accept the separation of power. And this, the story of the West is, in a way, interestingly the same way, that you have to believe in what you do. And that has been that's been questioned from sort of history, so from colonial past coming back, or from in the American context, Charlesville and all that sort of slavery and all that. But you're saying also from within the countries, people have ceased to believe that story.
West,
why would that
well,
be?
Well, the West, I suppose, the version of the West that I'm talking about. I mean, we can have this discussion about what the West means and what democracy means, and so on, going back to ancient Greece. But the version of the West that I mean now is the one that was conceived after the Second World War, and it was one in which the United States and which all the Western European countries had a major stake, and it was both an economic community and one that accepted certain rules. I mean, even though there were many, of course, different domestic arrangements, and there are a lot of deep differences, particularly between Europe and the United States, but that accepted free trade rules that created joint institutions like the European Union, like NATO, like the World Trade Organization, that, which enabled a kind of agreement about how we trade with one another, how we get along with one another, and which would allow us to build, if not build a joint government. I mean, there's never been any discussion of that, but allows us to sort of, to expect a certain order to pertain at least among our relationships. And then, of course, we had an enormous amount of success in exporting that model to other places. I mean, why is China able to trade with us? Because we set up these rules of free trade that turned out to work for them too. So there was a set of institutions which we accepted would regulate our relationships with one another. But those institutions require maintenance. They require, they require investment, and as you say, they also require belief. People have to think that they're important and think that they matter. And I should, I should stress that people have always questioned them. If you look back into the history of the West, if you look into, in the 1940s, when there were very strong, for example, communist parties in France and Italy, there was a lot of fear that this system would never take off. And then in the 1970s. In the wake of Vietnam and the oil crisis, there was a lot of questioning of American leadership. Do we really want this system? As the then Soviet attempt to influence it and undermine it was then, of course, very strong. So there's nothing new about this. What we have now, though, for the first time, first of all, what we have now is that for the very first time, the United States is questioning the system. And Trump, I think it's very important not to underestimate, he may be sui generis. I mean, he may be gone and he may leave no trace behind him because he's such a peculiar president. But he does some of the things that he said, and his questioning of, does America have to be the world's policeman? Why do we still have armies in Europe? Europe is rich. Why are we defending Europe? Some of those themes are real themes in the United States. You can hear them in a lot of places. You can hear them in Congress. They resonate across the country. So for the first time since really World War II, you have very strong isolationist sentiment in America, and that isolationist sentiment has produced a president. And that's the first one we've had really in living memory, since the 30s.
So, there, I guess one of the main discussions or trying to explain this populist uprising, trying to explain a phenomenon like Trump.
And we should, at some point, we talked about this before, populist uprising is a very broad statement.
Authoritarian tendencies.
Yeah,
okay,
because
yes.
we talk about
there are different kinds of populism.
There are different kinds of populism. We all agree that.
I know one has to use shorthand or else you get caught spending the whole conversation picking things apart. But yes.
Trying to explain a phenomenon like Trump or the rise of right-wing authoritarianism in Europe, for example, there's this debate going, and I know you have opinions on this, whether is this a backlash against globalization? Has this to do with economic insecurities, or is this something else? Has this to do with something cultural, something, you know, in a new generation not accepting the former social contract for whatever reason? So how do you explain it?
I think there are different strands to it, and you also have to have look a little bit differently at each country. I mean, as we're having this conversation, we're sitting in Poland, and I hope we get to that, because Poland is a very interesting, strange case where you really cannot argue that the cause of the Polish far-right government, that it was caused by economics, because this is a country that's had a huge amount of economic success.
Or immigration.
And growth, or immigration, because there isn't any.
Yeah.
But maybe we might return to that.
Yes.
But I think you have to pick these things apart, and I think they are, you know, and they interact together. And, of course, you know, the economic arguments are well-known, and you might not want to rehearse them here, but yet, you know, it's true that globalization did... it has created more wealth around the world, but in particular countries and particular places, it is blamed for having created, undermined particular industries. And so we know there are, you know, in the American Midwest or in the British, the industrial north, or in probably the German industrial north, you know, you can hear people complain that they've lost their jobs to China. Whether or not this is true is another argument. Some of these, you know, from what a lot of the statistics I've seen show that the real threat to, you know, a certain model, an economic model that we got used to for most of the 20th century, the real threats are really technological rather than to do with trade. And they're to do with the rise of automation and the use of computers. We know that. So whether or not it's real is a different question. I mean, I think it's important to focus on, we can have a long argument about what are the real economic impacts of global trade, because, of course, global trade has done a lot of good things, even for poor people, you know, providing cheaper products and so on. But it's very interesting to look at the psychological impact of free trade and the way in which people understand it. And that's where you begin to, you have a sense in a lot of societies of insecurity and of threat, you know, that our somehow we our civilization is under threat, our way of life is under threat. In some places it takes a racial overtone. Our white race, or our, I don't know, Swedish nation, or our German nation is under threat. And it's under threat both from this sense of, you know, this is why immigration played such a huge role in political arguments in Europe over the last 2 or 3 years, but it's also an idea that our governments and the people who run our countries are not really in control anymore of our societies. So a decision made in China affects a factory here in Bavaria, or our leaders are not able to make decisions that, you know, keep our nation safe and so on. So the idea that we have somehow lost control, that we aren't in control of our destiny, that other people are in control, and that those people, you know, have with different values from us or threatening us, I think is something you see a version of that in a lot of different countries right now. And the question is, you know, why now? And I think part of the answer is economic. Part of it is to do with the wave of immigration in the last couple of years. Part of it is to do with trade. Part of it is also to do with the way in which people now get and process political information, what people see. And this is an argument that I've made a lot, which is that it's really to do with the nature of political information as you see it on the internet.
Yeah.
And
we should come back to that. I'm super, super, super interested in that. We should talk about that. But if we just stay with the... it's interesting what you said about the usual explanations for the rise of right-wing extremism. Are you content with that, George?
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, I'll countries, explain later
there's also left-wing extremism.
I know. But
let me later explain why. I insist on being
later
a little careful with populism.
Yes. Please explain that to me.
I will.
Anyway, but looking at a country like mine, for example, like Sweden, where we've had great success for the right-wing extremist populist party and it's very much connected in the public discourse to immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think looking at timelines, it's also partly true that they did gain a lot of votes when we had this immigration, a refugee crisis a couple of years back. But looking at a country like Poland, that is just not the case. And so the explanation models for Western Europe doesn't seem to apply to all of Europe.
No, except that this current Polish government did use the threat of immigration,
yes,
as a sort of political weapon very successfully. In other words, we don't have any immigrants, we don't want any,
mm,
and Europe is trying to force us to have them. And if you elect this populist government, we will protect you from this threat. And we see that this threat is very bad for other European countries. You know, I'm just parroting what they say.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
It causes terrorism. Black people are, much more likely to be terrorists than anybody else. And if we have these people in, we will also have terrorism, and we will also have, I don't know, slums just like in Belgium or Paris.
Mm.
And so that argument was used here successfully. But I think it also played into something I was alluding to a minute ago, which is a feeling that many small nations have, and Poland isn't even the smallest.
No.
Poland is a pretty big country. But many small nations have a kind of, demographic threat. Like, will we still exist? You find this in Hungary, by the way, which really is a small nation and which speaks a weird language that nobody else understands. And so they have this paranoia about, can we survive in this world? Hungarian friends said, we live in this sea of Slavs. Can we maintain our culture? And this feeling that we're small nations, we can easily be overwhelmed. We need to somehow protect our national language and our national identity and even our racial identity in order to survive in this complicated world. And this kind of line, it's not always said exactly out loud like that, although sometimes it is.
Mm.
But this kind of feeling that, we need to protect ourselves is one you hear quite a lot in this part of the world, and also, I think, in Western Europe. And so here, in a weird way, the absence of immigrants.
Mm.
I mean, this is a fascinating, and it's a little digression, but a fascinating analysis was done in Britain after the Brexit vote. And of course, it turns out that people are much more pro-Brexit. In other words, the more contact you have with immigrants and the more time you spend with people who aren't British, the more happy you are with the EU and the less anti-immigration you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who were most anti-immigration in Britain, mm-hmm, and most inclined to vote Brexit are people who live in places where there aren't any immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So in Eastern Europe, you have a sort of little mini version of that, where you have countries which don't have any immigrants, mm-hmm, or tiny numbers,
mm-hmm,
Who are against them because they're foreign.
Mm.
So, it's a complicated.
Yeah, I think I saw some analysis on the Swedish local elections that the Swedish Democrats, which is our right-wing extremist party, have the most support, or had the most increase in support, in places which were close to somewhere where there were a lot of immigrants.
But didn't have any themselves.
But didn't have any themselves. So it was kind of on the horizon, but it wasn't, they didn't know,
right,
it wasn't, at home.
Right, so right. And so it's this sort of fear of some, of outsiders, but it's also this sense of, it's kind of demographic challenge. Can we survive as a nation? Yeah, because it's a little bit less true here, but it's more true in Hungary, and more true, you can hear that in Slovakia.
Mm.
And other small East European countries. I suspect you can hear it in parts of Scandinavia too.
Can I try to approach the present moment from a perspective that you know a lot about? And I think it's interesting to think about the present crisis of democracy as the 20th century, the revenge of some of the mistakes or misfortunes of the 20th century playing out. One being the separation of Europe that has happened before, so if I guess, or that we could talk about
you
that.
Mean, you mean from 1945?
The East and West. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so you can always talk about sort of the Slavophil influence in, I think, Poland especially was always a place torn between both countries, Russia and Prussia.
But not really, but anyway, yes.
Yeah, but somehow the divide being maybe older than the Cold War, but the main focus, what's coming back, I think, is the disruption or not disruption of 89, so of the West winning, and a generation later, those values being questioned. A generational problem, maybe. So if the 50-year-olds who won 89 are still running the show and think that's how it should be done, and the 22-year-olds who grew up in this world struggle with that.
Yeah, so there are two parts of your question. I mean, I actually disagree about the division of Europe. I think one of the things that has happened in the last 25 years is that Europe really has been integrated. And, you know, the kinds of problems that you have here and the kinds of problems that you have in Sweden aren't actually as different as you would imagine. I mean, I tend to think that even Viktor Orban, you know, how different was he really from Marine Le Pen? I mean, if you hear how he talks and you hear how she talks, it was quite similar. I mean, I guess, okay, so he won, but that was, you know, that was for other reasons too. He had a particularly weak opposition.
So they became similar in
negative. I think actually they were similar. Exactly. I think they've grown similar in both positive and negative things. However, the second part of your point, which is about the generational change, I think is really important. And one of the things we see here is that, as you say, the feeling of having won the Cold War is, and having experienced a lifetime of improvement is something that older people definitely have. And younger people don't have, because they don't compare themselves in their lives to that of their parents. They don't say, look, my mother was much poorer than I am. Look how much richer I am. And by the way, I should say that in Poland, regardless of what class you're in, you know, regardless of, you know, whether you're in the lowest part of the working class, your standard of living is higher than your parents' was. There is just nobody for whom that's not true. But what they do now is they compare themselves to their peers in Germany or in Sweden. And so they say, why did Germans earn three times what we earn? You know, we don't understand. You know, and there's a kind of revolt against, because now they travel, and people in this country travel a lot. They go back and forth. They work abroad. They study abroad. They come back and forth. And so why, you know, there's a resentment that, you know, the rest of Europe is still so much far ahead of us. I mean, it's, of course, illogical in a certain sense, because Poland has, in the last two decades, you know, made more, you know, it's had really the best two decades, you know, in about 300 years. I mean, and it has made more strides in catching up towards the rest of Europe than it has in a couple of centuries.
So if that's the case, what could have been done differently? Where was the rupture? Where maybe the... Another
well,
word,
first,
lead,
first
so
of all, first of all,
it's not, let me explain to you later, George, how first, not to use the word elite.
First of all, it's not a permanent situation. I mean, there are some oddities about Poland as well. I mean, this is again true in every country. I mean, just like it's sort of an amazing piece of luck that Macron won the presidency in France, and you know,
he might lose it now.
I mean, you know, and his the whole, you know, the falling apart of the right wing and the. I mean, Marine Le Pen's poor performance. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why he won, other than the ideology he represented. It's really the same story here, that they won because of the left divided and the center-right divided, and there were, you know, the various parties. There was an odd election, and they also, they were, you know, for the first time, they made use of a tactic that arose again in the American election, which was the use of private conversations and private material that were made into non-scandals using the internet. So there were a number of things that happened here that were unusual. And they still don't, this far-right government still has never, ever represented more than 40% of the country. And in most polls, it's more like 30%. So the fact that they're running the country is a little bit of a fluke. And this is still the most pro-European country in the EU. If you ask people, do you like Europe? 80% say yes. And so you have an odd moment where a very anti-European government rules a pro-European country, and that's just, it happened because that was the way the election played itself out. So you have to be careful about these, you know, and just as France, I think, could still go the other way, this country could still go the other way too.
So just staying in Poland for a question or two, looking at the current moment with the veto from the president against the judicial reform, and there seems to be this really a real struggle between protesters and ambitions, authoritarian ambitions, and it's not clear.
So it's clear that this government has real authoritarian ambitions.
Yes.
And unlike Trump, actually, who I think has authoritarian instincts, but has no idea how to
Doesn't
have a plan. This party came to power with a plan, and their plan was to control the media, to control the judiciary, to control those sort of levers of power that are outside of executive control, and to make themselves the permanent government. And they've said that. Mm. I mean, that we expect to be running the country for 20 years. Mm. They've said. And they have run into enormous opposition, both media opposition and in the courts. And when they really tried to grab power by taking over the whole judicial system, there was these enormous street protests all across the country. And the president, who is actually technically of that party, I think was moved by the sight of the protests and to veto the legislation. I don't think the battle is over yet, but the protests made a difference, and in a way, the protests have been useful because there are a lot more people, particularly a lot of younger people, now understand better how the Constitution works. They understand better what the significance of having this kind of party in power is. There's a lot more political awareness than there used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, people in this country became very complacent. Things went really well for a long time, you know, for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the accession to the EU went well, and the accession to NATO went well. And Poland had a very good reputation in the world, and lots of people invested here and so on. And the end of that era, which people didn't really expect. I mean, I think if you had focused on politics and you knew a little bit about this party, you would have known this might happen. But most people didn't. You know, the end of that has woken up a lot of people, and I hope that will make a difference in the future.
Something that goes back to one of the questions that Karin raised about economics or culture or what's the driving force, and it's just
Poland is the argument for culture.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So if politics is downstream from culture, as I guess Andrew Breitbart said, the founder of Breitbart News, which arguably brought Trump to power, that seems to be the case extremely in this country with the reshaping of national memory. And from a German perspective, one of the aspects that is obviously most interesting is the war or the Holocaust. How would you see that? Is that somehow a place of national identity? Because is that contentious? And how would you sort of put it into the context of the struggle for the soul of this nation? So the Katyns of the Polish being victims of the Soviet Union seems to have overtaken in German perception sometimes the murder of the Jews, which also took place here. So that's from
right.
From
so this, this so Western let's pick it apart a little bit. So the really really important piece of historical politics that's happening here is actually neither to do with Russia or Germany. It's national. This government wants to rewrite the history of the last 25 years. And so they want to dethrone Lech Wałęsa. They want to downplay the Solidarity Movement, and they want to claim that they are the real Democrats, that this last 25 years was some kind of, you know, mistake, and, you know, that didn't really count, and now the real Poland is in charge, and we're really running the show. And so to do that, they need to rewrite the history of 1981. And this is something they're trying to do. So they downplay Wałęsa, they undermine him, they say terrible things about him. So, you know, there's a whole long...
What's the argument?
The argument is that he was really a police informer. You know, I mean, it's an extraordinary attempt to destroy somebody who... I mean, he's a flawed person, Wałęsa. He was a terrible president, you know, and so on. I mean, it doesn't really matter. But he's a national symbol, and to destroy your national symbol seems like an act of madness. You know, just like Nelson Mandela was the national symbol for South Africa, and he was also a flawed person, and he also made mistakes. But, you know, the South Africans didn't spend a lot of time trying to undermine it. But the Poles are trying to, this government anyway, is trying to undermine Wałęsa. And therefore, to rewrite history so that they are the true Democrats, or they're the true you know, somehow freedom was something that they brought about, which is, of course, a complete, you have to falsify history completely in order to justify that. In addition to that, yes, they like to be seen as victims. You know, Poland was a victim of its neighbors. Instead of seeing Germany as a series of previous governments, but particularly the government of the previous 8 years, saw it as a real partner and as a real friend, and as a country with whom it's worth being as close as possible. They see Germany as a a former enemy and occupier. I mean, this also plays into, they're trying to convince people here not to be pro-European. And so part of undermining Europe is undermining Germany and explaining that Germany is bad, not good. And the reason why they need to undermine Europe is that one of the obstacles that they're facing in their desire to create a political system that keeps them in power for 20 years, one of the big obstacles is the European Union. And so they would like to undermine their European Union, undermine Germany, and so on. I think it's more about that than anything else. The actual history of the war and the Holocaust is not discussed much right now. I don't think those are big issues. I mean, fun enough, even, you know, they haven't talked a lot about Russia either. They started this campaign about how we must ask Germany for war reparations, which is absurd on many levels. I mean, I think even they know it's not going to happen. But this was it's a campaign designed to create distance between Poland and Germany and Poland and Europe. But the most important piece of historical politics they're doing is about Polish history. And it's actually very shocking if you think about it. I mean, to attempt also to rewrite history while so many people are still alive who remember exactly what happened.
Is it working?
So it's not working for anybody I know, and it's not working, and I don't even think it's working that well for the majority, but it may well be working for the small, you know, remember, this is a party that wants to stay in power with a 30% support, which is not unlike Trump. I mean, actually, in a bizarre way, right now, the two countries that have the most similar political systems are the United States and Poland. Mm. So who knew why? I don't know why, but that's just how it's happened.
Here you are now.
It's strange for me. But yes, so they fire up their base, they feed their base with, you know, and they're hoping that the energy of their base and the energy of this 30%, 35% will get them reelected again. I mean, it certainly worked once. You know, that's how they were elected 2 years ago, and they would like to do that again. And for their base, yes, I guess it works. For most people, it doesn't.
So I want to go back to something you mentioned right at the beginning and talk a little bit about the role of Russia in European politics, and especially the connection between Russia and propaganda, how it plays out in national debates, and also the connection between Russia and the extreme right. And how you see that playing out.
So Russia has been either funding or helping in different ways the extreme right in almost every country in Europe, you know, for two decades. And my experience is that most Europeans very much underestimate and would be surprised to know how much of this is Germans in particular. I'm actually working right now on a project that is monitoring the sort of Russian internet Russia in Germany during the election campaign, and of course there's an enormous overlap between AfD, the German far right party, and sort of pro-Russian trolls and pro-Russian websites and so on. If you map out the internet, they overlap almost precisely in the kinds of messages they use and the kinds of people they're reaching and so on. So and they do that in every European country. They supported Marine Le Pen openly with funding. That was actually unusual because usually it's more subtle. I'm sure they support the Sweden Democrats.
Oh, yeah. No, that's well established.
Well established.
Not actually the party, but fringe groups close to the party.
Probably it's a lot of efforts made online.
Yes.
It, you know, they've worked out that that's a better way to support people than cash or direct. In Italy, nobody's done a proper examination of their role, but it's pretty clear they now have some connections to Beppe Grillo's party. He was very anti-Russian initially, and now he's pro-Russian, so something's happened.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Up in there. But in this part of the world, which is of course the part they know well, they're very linked. They're deeply linked into a number of, many right wing parties. It's important to remember that it's not only about parties and the internet. There has really three kinds of connections they make. The other is of course with business, and in many countries they seek business contacts very often for political reasons. So they look often for business contacts in the oil and gas and energy sectors, both because that's their strength and because those sectors are often politically influential and very deeply connected to the state. So that that's certainly the case in Italy. It's certainly the case in Germany. They also have they also seek contacts with mainstream politicians. So it's not just the far right. They look for friends. They look for sponsorships. They look for, in Germany, it's, again, once it's above board. It's Schroeder and other ex-politicians who can then serve as their spokesman. They hire people. They put people on their boards. They seek contacts and influence. And it's very obvious in Britain as well. And this is, it's not illegal to do that, but it's something that most people kind of dismiss or don't take seriously as an organized project. But that's what it is. So they look for the far right, often the far left as well. They use the internet, they make business contacts, and they also look for mainstream spokesmen who will get across their message.
Do you follow sort of that in Germany, for example, the liberal? The head of the Liberal Party, Christian Lindner, said that the Crimea should be a permanent provisorium. So he's basically saying, give it to Russia.
I saw that. I didn't know what to make of it.
And Sigmar Gabriel said that Trump should get going to go against Congress to get the sanctions off the table. So I'm really worried sort of about those temperamental changes in the central powerful country within Europe. I don't know what to make of it.
So I don't know what to make of the liberal. I assume that some of it is to do, again, with business interests. Again, there are a lot of companies who...
I think it all has to do with business interests.
Yeah,
also, Sigmar Gabriel, he's pretty open about that. But that doesn't make it better on a democratic level. So the ease with which democratic institutions... That goes back to the question of how can the West lose faith in its story if the politicians don't really live up to democratic ideals, obviously, and elected, highly elected officials, the foreign ministry, the German foreign ministry, Secretary of State, why would anybody sort of believe in that story if obviously they've sold out?
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. So I think that an underestimated role in undermining the West, since we're back to that theme, has also been played by... it's a combination of offshore funds, very large companies that don't have any real national or even any particular Western orientation. The amount of money that sloshes around the world now, and can be, and the number of people who have money who don't feel the need to pay taxes or to be involved in a national or a Western project is also a big challenge for the West. And this is something that we have allowed to have happen. We've let this happen.
Do you feel
and of course the how did Putin come to power? You know, Putin came to power by, originally it was through stealing money. He and others, I mean, not him by himself, but he and others stole money essentially from the Russian budget and then one way or another laundered it to the West and then laundered it back again. And there were a whole series of Western institutions that were complicit in that, you know, banks, you know, offshore companies, lawyers, tax accountants, and so on, who helped that happen and who made money out of that. I mean, you can in London, it's very clear, but also in the United States as well. And the, you know, because we were, you know, we were complicit in that, and we therefore helped bring this group of power people to power in Russia, and in a, you know, in a very, I mean, in a, you know, if I wanted to be kind of, I don't know what the right word is. You know, if you want to see some kind of karma in it, I mean, it's fairly clear that Donald Trump is somebody who was both part of that process and also a beneficiary of it, in that he was in real estate in New York at a time when a lot of real estate, and particularly luxury real estate in New York, was effectively a form of money laundering. People bought apartments in New York, they still do actually, in order to hide money, and lots of Russian money came into his companies. And so he floated to the top, but he may even have stayed in business thanks to Russian money, you know, of the kind that we had helped launder. In other words, so he is in a way a product of that same semi-corrupt, semi-legal economic system. That you know, Trump and Putin were created by the same series of processes.
It would be poetic justice.
That's the phrase I was looking for.
If this is what would bring him down.
Yeah, no, so it's, they are connected. I mean, it's not trivial, their connection. I mean, it's a real connection. Mm.
But isn't it interesting, or what you make of that, that you're talking to two more or less lefty journalists, and you're not known to be a lefty, or some would say you're even
I don't even know what these things mean anymore.
So we agree on a lot of...
Love what you say, but everybody needs to pay more taxes.
we might also disagree about a lot of things, but why is that? So is everything just off now?
I think our old definitions of what is left and what is right are outdated. And the argument that we had for, I don't know, 30 years that was really between the left and the right about the size of the state is no longer the central argument in politics. And the central argument is, and you know, there are a lot of reasons for this. If you think about what were the social bases, particularly in Europe, of the left and the right. I mean, the social bases of the left were the trade unions, and the social bases of the right was the church, Christian democracy, right? And that's true in most countries, actually, certainly in, you know, Netherlands, Germany, and so on. So the church doesn't matter anymore, at least not as much as it did, and neither do the unions. So what's really the social basis of these two big parties? Doesn't really exist anymore. You know, the main argument now, the most important arguments, are really about something else. And you can call it maybe open versus closed. You know, you can call it, you know, we still believe in global trading versus we want to shut our borders. And in a lot of countries, the really big political divides are over that. And in fact, that was the divide that characterized the final round of the French election. I mean, that was actually the clearest version of that divide that we've seen so far. I mean, Germany doesn't quite work, you know, and some other countries it doesn't quite work, and particularly when you have multiple party systems and so on. But the most important argument now, I think, is around those issues, rather than this older arguments about the size of the state, where the left and the right have been a lot closer for a long time. You don't agree?
No, I don't. No, I agree with the history you're writing, obviously, about the change of economic structures and the social basis of parties, that is not the case anymore. But I do think that liberals, and I use this in the European definition of the word, sometimes disregard the, you know, exploding inequalities and the and this kind of the upheaval of the social contract as also the cause for these insecurities and the cause for this rage or this sense of deep injustice that many people apparently are feeling. And I think that just talking about values and just talking about open versus closed doesn't won't
take
you
that. The problem is that the sense of rage doesn't match. You know, if you look back in history, you look back at the 30s, you know, when you had this, Germany in the 1920s and the devastation after World War One and the deep poverty and the 30s and the terrible depression and millions out of work. There's nothing like that now.
You know, it's like what you said.
It's all relative. It's true. Yes. And people feel relatively poorer of course they can now see how rich people live because they can watch it on Instagram every day. And that's also an important psychological part of the story. But the level of rage doesn't match the level of economic devastation. We're just not talking about massive impoverishment of the kind that we saw in the 20th century, first half of the 20th century. So I agree with you that there are, you know, and again, you have to look country by country. I agree that there are economic causes, but they can't, you know, economics don't explain the whole thing. You have to look at the psychology of the economics, as I said. So the economics have created these feelings of insecurity, these feelings of being left behind, and above all, this feeling of loss of control. Remember, this was the winning slogan in the Brexit campaign in Britain: "Take back control."
Yeah,
I mean, it was phony in that the British are going to have less control than they did before. But take back control is something that appealed to a lot of people: the sense that things are, you know, we're not in charge anymore. And yet, if I agree, there's an economic source of that, and there's a political source of it, and I think there's also there's a piece of it that has to do with news and information.
Yeah. I obviously agree with that. There is a complicated interplay between cultural and economic factors, and some of the loss of identity and some of the rage that people are feeling, it's not about loss of economic status, but more of a, you know, societal status.
Also, in the United States, there's a clear, you know, I mean, and they'll say this. I mean, there's a clear sense that some white people have that we are losing status to colored people, you know, to black people. And there's a sense that men have that we're losing status to women.
Yes.
I mean, you know, those aren't economic, you know, but white men feel they're
economic.
You know, it's also economic, but it's also a sense that, okay, we used to run everything, and now these black people and women run everything. I mean, sorry to be, I'm simplifying for the sake of argument, but, you know, a lot of the, what was the resentment, this terrible resentment against Obama was partly that he was black, and, you know, the natural order, the hierarchy that we are used to had been overturned. You know, and that's part of what's making people angry. It's not just about money.
No, it's not just about money. And sometimes I think that we talk a lot about the immigration shocks and so on, but we haven't talked that much about the shock to society that comes from half of the population in a couple of generations entering the workforce. I mean, women competing with men in the workforce. And that's cultural, but it's also economic. What happens with...
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that may well be part of what... Certainly in the United States, I think that's a big part of what people are reacting against. And that was a part of what people didn't like about Hillary Clinton. You know, she was female, and she represented... Not just that, but she... represented a kind of female power that people resented.
But I also do strongly agree with you that the rage doesn't really match doesn't match anything. It doesn't match economics. It doesn't match.
No.
I'm interested in your argument about platforms and social media and the new information infrastructure and how that affects us. If you can, and affects the.
As a rage machine?
How that affects the political discourse.
So how do most people now get their information? I mean, again, this varies a little from country to country, I know, but more and more people get their information from social media. And that means that what they see is material that has been, they've selected or that has been recommended to them by their friends. And so more and more, they choose to see material that reinforces things that they already believe. And this has been shown multiple times in multiple different kinds of studies, that the more time you spend online, the more, the narrower your views become and the more likely you are to want to reinforce your own views with those of people who agree with you. And the nature of the Facebook algorithm in particular is such that it will show you more and more what you've already seen. So what you want, you know, what you want is what you get. And it is able to identify what you like and give you more of it. And this phenomenon has helped, it's done two things. Number one, it's undermined the business model of the mainstream media. So you have much weaker, again, varies from country to country, but in many countries you have much weaker traditional press because the advertising model, the business model of the traditional press has been undermined by the social media platforms. But the other thing it's done is it has allowed people to sort of organize themselves differently. And again, this is another thing that's undermining the political parties. Is people find online, you know, their group or their set of friends or their set of news sources and things that they believe in, and they are, you know, much more cut off from everybody else. And what you had, in a lot of countries, not every country, but many of them, certainly absolutely in Poland and absolutely in the United States, you have lost a center ground, the center ground as a place where a national debate can take place. So national debate doesn't exist anymore. You don't have a space where everybody agrees as neutral, whether it's the state broadcaster or, the parliament. Instead of having that, you have people listening to their own, they stay inside their own echo chambers or their own filter bubbles, and they hear what they want to hear. And this is partly a phenomenon that existed anyway, and that's why it's worse in particular countries where those kinds of divisions already existed. But there is no question that the internet exacerbates it. And the internet does other things too. I mean, there are all kinds of studies again that show that the more time you spend on Twitter and Facebook, the angrier you get, and also the kind of language that gets you attention, like if you want to get a lot of likes, the language is harsher. Mm. You know, you have to be harsher, cleverer, more extreme. And over time, people's language online becomes more extreme. And that's it. That's one of the things that social media has done to political discourse.
So I'm thinking a lot about this at the moment. And I guess the business model of Facebook, I mean, what they want is for people to stay as long as possible on their platforms. That's their business model, because that gives them more access to your data, and that's what they make money from. And the way to do that is to keep you engaged and keep you emotional. Mm-hmm. So they promote stuff that keeps your... Well, it's a rage machine, basically. The platforms promote content that makes you angry, super sentimental,
and cats
makes you laugh. But I'm wondering, so that would, in and of itself, create spirals like the ones you're talking about. But the math, also just thinking about how big this company is, Facebook, with 4 mm-hmm. billion users and 2 billion users every day. I sometimes think that we haven't, as societies, at all thought about what this means.
No, and I agree with that.
And I guess my question is, if we think about this as a problem, which I think it is, where should the pushback come from, and how should we think about this as if it's a democratic problem?
I think it's a big democratic problem. Yeah. And I think they know it too. So they're different issues, they're different platforms. But Facebook, I think, has very deliberately tried to avoid talking about this as a problem because this is how they're making money. Even fake news makes them money. So they don't want to be seen as publishers. They don't want to be subject to regulation. And they continue to want to present themselves as a sort of, we're just a neutral space. You know, we're just a technology. You know, we're not shaping the way anybody thinks. But actually, you know, they are, and their algorithms do. So I think there are a number of things that are going to happen. I mean, I think for one thing that will happen is that in the next few years, there will be attempts to regulate Facebook. I think Germany's already trying to do it. If only to make Facebook liable to local and national laws. So lots of, the United States doesn't, but lots of European countries do have laws on hate speech, or they do have laws on, I don't know, the use of Nazi symbols, or and Facebook will have to conform to those. There could well be more, more deeper attempts to regulate it. And there could be, as people begin to understand better how it works, there could be more questions about what is their algorithm and how it works and so on. There may be questions.
Do you think
about,
that would be a good thing?
I have, I'm ambivalent. I think it's a good thing to have the discussion about how it works, because I think most people don't really understand it. I don't want to see, I'm nervous about the precedents that could be set by attempts to regulate what people can and can't post. And anyway, people would find ways around it, so I'm not sure it's worth going there. But larger, broader, and wider national conversations about what it is and how it works and what it's doing to institutions, I think, would be useful. I tend to think that a lot of the responses to the problem are going to be multiple. So there will be a government response, there will be a kind of NGO response. I mean, there's already multiplying groups and people and academic programs and NGOs which are, which attempt to do fact-checking online, which attempt to do counter-messaging, which attempt to push back against, for example, the Russian and authoritarian attempts to manipulate the internet. And you will see a kind of social online response in the way you would see, in a way that you saw the people go on the streets in Poland to object to judicial reform. Mm. And that's beginning to happen. Mm. And so I think some of it is going to come from, I don't know, for lack of a better expression, civil society. I mean, I have a teenage son who's upstairs right now who refuses to be on Facebook because he says, I know they steal my data and I don't want them to know who my friends are.
Good for him. Trust the next generation.
And generally speaking, in his generation, people are much more suspicious of it and wary of it and aware of how it can be used and how they use your data to advertise and so on. So there's going to be a learning process in the way there was a learning process about how to use radio or how to use television when those mediums were first came to.
Can I just ask?
You remember that the person who really, really loved the radio was Hitler.
Yeah.
He knew how to use it. He understood how powerful it was. The other person who really, really liked it was Stalin. Mm-hmm. And in the book I wrote about Eastern Europe, I read it, one of the first things absolutely that the Red Army did when they came to Eastern Europe was set up radio stations because they thought it was absolutely the most important.
Because it's unfiltered mass.
It was unfiltered, but also it was a form of mass communication. Yeah. It was only later that then, we had Radio Free Europe, which could undermine it. And then we understood, then Roosevelt also invented a form of radio that was unifying. I mean, there was a whole series of things that happened as people grappled with the new technology and learned how to use it. And I think that will happen with this too. And so when I'm feeling optimistic, I think that the civic response will be...
How often do you feel optimistic?
It goes in waves. Some of it will have to be conscious. So if we had a different American president, I can imagine right now the United States investing a lot of money into understanding better how, for example, just how Russian manipulation works.
Yeah.
Like, it's not only a Russian problem, but the Russians, I think, were ahead of the curve in understanding how to do it. But understanding how it works and monitoring it, and you could put money into doing that in useful ways.
At the same time, if we hadn't had these social media platforms, he wouldn't have been president. So
Who? Trump?
Trump. That's
No, that's, I think that's probably true.
But just one last question on this issue. We were talking about the mismatch between the rage and the real world. So,
right.
Do you think, how important do you think this particular factor is?
The internet.
Yes.
I think it's incredibly important.
Is it the explanation?
I think it's not the explanation. There are a lot of explanations, but, look around the world. Look at the government in the Philippines. Look at the government. Look at Trump. Look at Modi in India. If you look around the world, there's a certain kind of person who's coming to power everywhere, And almost all of them are doing it with the, you know, with the help of a superior understanding of how to use Facebook. Mm. I mean, Duterte was employed people who were manipulating, who were attempting to manipulate social media in a very similar way to the way that the Trump team did it. Mm. So it's a factor in politics everywhere, and it seems to be changing politics everywhere. And these are countries that have nothing in common. Mm. I mean, why should the Philippines happen to have the same kind of leader that the United States has right at this particular moment in history? It's never happened before. So, you know, what is the common factor in all these places? And the common factor is Facebook or social media. Mm. There are different platforms. Yeah. Facebook is the biggest, but there are others that matter too.
Can I come back to something if you start off at the beginning, there's a reconfiguration of how politics is done and conceived, and I think the role of technology is really interesting in another aspect, not specifically only in the way that they can be used to communicate with each other, but it's how it influences the way people on a very basic level see the world and expect things, reactions from the world. You talked
about
this.
There's another issue, the
issue of speed, the issue of immediacy, the issue of reactions, the issue
this is something else
gratification, the issue sort of...
It's very frustrating. We now are used to the idea that you can express an opinion by clicking a like button, and you can press another button and someone will deliver a book to your house the next day, you know, or a pair of shoes. And everything can happen really fast. And so why then is democracy so incredibly slow? And why does politics seem to lag behind? And why, you know, it's as if all these things can be done quickly, and yet our political decisions and our political process takes years to work out, and there are these boring coalitions. And this desire for things to happen faster, this is also an authoritarian desire, you know. What if we just got rid of all these democratic procedures? They're time-consuming and exhausting, and someone could just decide. You know,
so
wouldn't
it doesn't
that be
make
better?
Sense that Trump seems like a child, because that's a tantrum-like approach to the world.
So, you know, we could just make everything happen much faster. But, I mean, it's something that people who are used to now every day getting what they want in 15 seconds, because you can do it on the internet, you can see the frustration with politics. The other thing that the internet does, and this is a little bit more subtle, is that the internet is a distancing, you know, you feel distant from real life when you're using it. You're kind of one step away from things that are actually happening. And that's why, of course, the internet is so full of irony and parody and jokes and memes. You know, it's a very easy place. And you can kind of laugh at the world from your perspective on social media. And, of course, the internet has also given birth to not only dictatorial political candidates, but also joke candidates. And we see this phenomenon of joke candidates, you know, comedians who get elected. And in a way, Trump is one of those, you know, an unserious person who becomes a political leader. But you see it in Italy, you see it in Serbia, you see it here, actually. We have a rock musician in parliament who's got a, you know, ridiculous party. It's very, very common as well. And I think that's also a product of a generation brought up on, you know, this kind of constant sharing of jokes online. It's a medium that gives you a sense of distance, and that's a little bit different from the way newspapers work or radio.
But the parallel to the radio is kind of uncomfortable, or what Karen said, so how can democratic forces take charge of that technology? And the 30s, you say, democratic governments took 10 to 15 years to realize or to employ the power
absolutely.
Of technology.
No, I mean, if you look at the invention, the real precedent is the invention of the printing press. Mm. Think about the invention of the printing press. This was a technology that instantly allowed all kinds of scurrilous pamphlets to be printed, also all kinds of anti-establishment pamphlets. What was the end result? It was the Reformation. That was one of the results of the printing press. Which, you know, you guys being from Germany and Sweden, you think that's good, but, you know, but it did cause 100 Years' War.
You know, also more or less created the United States.
Also George, the Gregorians. So.
George right, so. Wrote the book about Martin Luther.
Okay, so, you know, I'm not good or bad, it doesn't matter, but just looking at it...
But we're sitting in Poland, so the
it created this massive revolution, which took 100 years to work out. Remember, there was the 30 Years' War, and there were Catholic-Protestant battles, you know, all over Europe. And
but there wasn't a state, so you could argue there wasn't the sense of a clear actor in the game.
Of course it wasn't the same, but my point is...
It's a super disruptive element in society.
My point is that it was very disruptive and that it took, you know, a couple hundred years to work it out before we got back to being more or less peaceful again.
Yeah, but then you have the state as an actor, and that basically maybe is one... I mean, actually, it's the consequence of the printing press. If you say the Treaty of Westphalia is the end of all that, mm-hmm. and that's where the state as an actor... becomes an element in European politics, that is the actor that is made to deal with technological change.
Right. Well, now we have a form of technology which undermines the state.
Yeah. So yeah. How do we?
And we have economic systems that undermine the state, and we have, you know, people are now able to, you know, the good side of globalization, right? People can communicate all over the world in real time, and they can. Watch, they can get information from different parts of the world. That's also undermines the state used to control information.
On the other hand, the people who are using technology want to have a strong state. That's their platform. That's the same, as you say, in Poland. That's the same in the United States. So that's the, I wouldn't say
they're
irony.
These are the nationalists.
And it's a revolt against the globalization regime, which...
the nationalists want to bring back that power. They want, and that's why they do stuff like crack down on the internet. You know, that's what, you know, and here they're going to, I don't know if they're going to really do it or not, but they're talking about so-called repolonization of industries, which would mean kicking out foreign companies. So I don't know, they may not do that because there are also laws of economics, which tell you that if you start messing around with, some of this has happened before, right? I mean, we've had nationalization before and... that's what communism was, right? It was a sort of supercharged state which controlled everything. And that ended in failure. So some of this is, you know, feels a little bit deja vu.
So the headline of this podcast would be Facebook is creating 100 years of war.
That's some news.
That's
newsworthy.
I mean, again, there are all these other factors as well, but,
I really agree with you. I mean, not on the headline, but on the disruptive impact.
But can we have something positive? Potential. We always want to have something positive.
Yes, something positive.
What should happen, what will happen, we can't, so I refuse to leave like that.
Yeah.
So I think if you want to look at something positive, I think you could look at the ways in which these big political shocks have usefully given people, you know, some understanding, first of all, of their own political systems, and second of all, of the importance of being involved in democracy. Yes. And third of all, suddenly we understand how weak some of our systems were. I mean, you know, the United States, you know, so much of it turns out, so much of the kind of norms that we, you know, the way the president behaved and so on, those weren't laws. Those were accepted customs and habits that nobody really thought about. You know, why did the president release his taxes? They just did. And every president since Nixon has published his tax form. And Trump, there wasn't a law that said you had to do it. It was just a custom. And so understanding better, we understand our systems better. People are much more inspired to be involved in politics. And democracy really doesn't work if people are alienated from it. And so one of the effects of this wave of populism may be to bring people back into politics and bring people to be more involved in their communities in a way that wasn't before. And that's happened here. That's happened in the United States. It's happened a little bit even in Britain. People became much more politically active after the Brexit vote.
And Macron wouldn't have won without Trump.
Macron would not have won without Trump.
Yeah.
Macron would not have won without Trump. And the reaction against Trump and the reaction against those waves may wake people up, oh, wait, what is the European Union? Maybe it's useful to us. Maybe it's worth fixing it or making it work better. This is a whole other, argument. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe if the United States is not going to be so involved in Europe, maybe Europe needs a foreign policy. I mean, that's something that nobody's, particularly the Germans, haven't really wanted to talk about for 40 years. So there are a lot of weaknesses in our system that have been exposed, and now we see them, and now we can work on them.
But I agree
we call this podcast the wake up call.
Yeah, no, I just want to make that point.
No, just leave it there.
No, which is interesting because democracy doesn't, and that's a takeaway that
it
I didn't know before. No, it doesn't work if you don't believe in it.
Yes.
So it's a magic trick.
So the
that's
magic
the
beauty
of it.
So that's why we'll call it.
Well,
the
make
it
wake up call could also be that the magic.
You have
poof,
to,
is
you have
going
to believe
away.
It. I mean, you have to believe it. It's not a question of faith. You have to think it through. Why democracy and why not dictatorship? It takes some time and effort. But you're right. You have to believe in it, and you have to work actively to make it better. And people at all different levels of society, from the highest to the lowest, have to be part of that. Have to be part of the debate and part of the. You know, the hundreds and hundreds of interlocking institutions and groups and organizations that make democracy possible, from, I don't know, the Rotary Club to the Machine Tool Builders Association to the
to this podcast
to the to the Congress, to the Parliament, to the Bundestag. You know, all these are different parts of the system, and every, you know, all of us are part of it in some way, but having it revealed to us or having it reminded to us why it's valuable, I think is quite useful.
Thank you.
Thank you.